Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello.
And Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody. Welcome.
So, gentlemen, I have a question I want to throw to the council here. I write books, you know.
What? Thing. When?
Sometimes I dabble. Sometimes I swim with maybe great white sharks. I don't know. I'm not saying anything. I don't know. Maybe, you know, maybe eight of them at one time outside of a cage. Who knows? Can't say. But anyhow, what I want to talk about, though, is audiobooks, audiobook formats, things like this. Normally, when I do a book with, let's say, my Jessica Blackwood series with HarperCollins, they do the audiobook. They get the audiobook rights. They do that. I did my new book series with Thomas and Mercer, Theo Cray. They do the audiobooks. I had audiobooks done with Tantor for Orbital and Station Breaker, and I thought they did a really good job producing those, putting those out there. I have some other books, and audiobooks are exploding. I've been approached by a audiobook publisher who's like, hey, we'd like to publish these other audiobooks. And part of me is like, cool, you know, hey, money. They'll pay me money for the rights, and they'll do the adaptations on it and all that. But another part of me is like, hey, I've had conversations with friends in the industry who took audiobooks real seriously, produced their own. Amazon or Audible has a program called ACX where you can either split with a narrator producer or pay outright and basically own the, you know, the lion's share of the book, get 50% of the profits for every audiobook, you know, sold. Plus they do things like bonuses. So if I say, hey guys, hey, check out my book on Audible, and somebody, the first book they get is my book, then you get a $50 bonus.
So like doing it yourself for a better cut, basically.
Yeah, that's the advantage. Is you do it yourself, you get a much better cut. You have higher upfront costs. You either have to produce it yourself or pay somebody to produce it. But I'm looking at like residuals return, and it's like,
Well, so one of the things this is similar to, I think Tim Ferriss told the story of when it came time to publish a book. He had a number of publishers that were interested. But he started to realize, like, well, what did the publisher do for me last time? Because basically publishers are in a weird spot where, yeah, they want good books, but good books are a dime a dozen. What they want is an author with a reputation and a name and a platform who can move those books. And then, of course, different publishers have different abilities to push them with large-scale buyers. But if I'm remembering the Tim Ferriss story correctly, he ultimately said, well, how hard would it be to make a publishing company? And now anyone could get their book printed, but that's not the same. You know, you have to have certain standards and everything. So he did. He built a publishing company to publish his next book because he knew that that he wouldn't have to give up any money that way. And he knew that he could use his platforms to move it. And now he publishes, I believe, other people's books as well. It seems like that we're entering a similar age in the audiobook age, as now all of a sudden, because everybody is carrying a device on them at all times that make it possible to listen to whatever audio entertainment they like. Now we're seeing another land rush. And so it would make sense that in the early days, that's a big boon for audiobook publishers. But now a lot of people, I would imagine, are figuring out, oh, wait, what happens if I just publish my audiobook?
Well, and that's it. There's a point where it's like, no, the amount of time you'll spend versus what you will make on it, it's not really worthwhile to do it. But, and for most authors, that's the case. But I'm in a position now where I look at, like, I started by doing audiobooks. We did our own with Public Enemy Zero. Justin did the narration for it. Mm-hmm. And we sold a few of those. We did pretty well. The ACX didn't exist then. You know, we didn't have a really easy way to put it on Amazon. Had that existed, I think things would have been different. And then I got out of the way of doing it. You know, and then I look at, like, you know, the offers right now for, you know, I have a great agent, and so I'm very happy with, you know, the way things work out there. But I look at it with the fact I have a platform. I don't have a Tim Ferriss sized platform, but we have Weird Things, I have After Things. I have, you know, pretty good Twitter following. I have a pretty extensive email list. And I look at it like, well, man, just getting people to read the first book, if I get them to sign up, you know, getting those Audible signups through there, that alone can be pretty lucrative. I know, you know, Scott Sigler's talked about like how much he's made. Like when that first started, you know, he did really well by that. And Scott's, you know, doing extremely well by his audiobooks. He does very smart things. He gets great narrators who have their own following to do this. And so it's like, yeah, you're trying to say, like, for me, it's like, I haven't done it because of the time, you know, and then I didn't do audiobooks or Station Breaker and Orbital because of time. And then a publisher came along and says, hey, we'll go do this. You know, for me, it was kind of like thinking, well, maybe it should be worth my time to do this. And, you know, and that's the thing, is if you have a platform and I have a platform, kind of like maybe, you know.
Well, it certainly seems like you could do it, but I do wonder that the time is a big, you know, element of it. You know, if you're handing it off to someone, you can say, cool, pay now and figure it out. And well, you don't have to get into the weeds on it.
You know, the ACX program, which was Audible, has this program which allows you to produce your audiobook through there. Okay. And the way it works is basically you can go in there and you can say, hey, I want to find a narrator and I'll split the profits with them. That's one way to do it. Mm-hmm. Or you can go in there and say, hey, I will pay somebody. I'll hire a narrator to do my audiobook and I'll pay them up front. But then it's exclusively distributed through Audible. That's the only platform it goes from. But it's kind of like, I hate to say this, but I kind of feel like the same way I do about Amazon in general when it comes to ebooks. It's the platform. It really is the platform. I've rooted for other platforms, but their tools aren't as good. They're not as author friendly as they try to be. And it's been frustrating because I get people, why don't you use our platform from this? Cause I can't do this. I can't. Oh, we're going to, you should support us. I'm like, you should support the people you want to use your platform, not say, you know, have me give up something else.
How much do you think you would have to lean on ACX to provide or get you in contact with, you know, producer or a narrator?
Oh, it is. It's a very streamlined system. If you go there, it's literally you say, hey, put out a request. You do this. Okay. So they've got the system done really well. I would like to find out, I'd be willing to pay for a really good popular narrator too. That's the thing, is I'd be willing to pay the money to get somebody who's got name recognition. And I'm going to, you know, part of the thing that's in the back of my head as I talk to my agent about this whole thing is that back in 1975, George Lucas made a deal with 20th Century Fox for Star Wars films, and he had a pretty good deal up front, but then they went over budget and they renegotiated. And the one thing Lucas was able to cling to was, of course, the merchandising rights, because at that point it wasn't really valuable. And that's the way audiobook rights have sort of been thought about. Ebook rights were sort of like, we'll see if that really blossoms. And then the ebooks became big and I make most of my money from ebooks. And then I feel that way about audiobook rights, where it's like, it doesn't make that much money. It's like there are people making a lot with it and it's growing. It's going to be bigger, not smaller. And that's for part of me is like, do I want to sell a bunch of my titles now? I mean, I'll keep coming up with new stuff that I could do that for, but
It sounds worth at least trying it out for one of your titles. You know, I don't know if you're in a do or die situation with this offer, but
I guess also you really do kind of only sell off those rights once and forever, because all the audiobooks I've heard from yours that have been done by the existing publishing houses, they sound good enough that I can't imagine anyone's going to go back and do a better version of the reading for all that stuff. So it is kind of a forever decision that you make, and you just got to make sure that whatever it is, like, that's going to be the audiobook recording of note. And so you'll need to, I have a friend who figured out how to use Photoshop, and because he was using Photoshop, he used the tools of Photoshop, and he thinks that what he's doing is great. And I'm not saying you lack the eye of quality, but he lacked the eye of quality. And as a result, you know, I was like, well, that's your poster. Okay. I guess you don't know what you don't know. Right. And that's the only downside to doing this is there's some level of expertise that you're buying when you buy into one of these ecosystems. But then having said that, like, I've worked with traditional publishers and it's like, you give up control and they might not care about certain parts the way you care about those certain parts.
So I've had friends that worked with publishers that then went to go said, oh, we'll do the audiobooks. And then part of that deal, that publisher then went used to ACX and used some rando. I've had people that like, who've had bad narrators on their books and they're locked in because they did the partnership agreement and they can't, you know, which is like, that's one thing I'm like, I would rather, because like, they're like, oh, it's cheap. We just do a profit split. It's like, yeah, and your audiobook sucks and nobody buys it. So you're doing a profit loss. So I would be like, for me, like, I'd be willing to pay up front for a really good name. And like suggestions in here, people mentioned R.C. Bray. There are people out there that like, you know, like if I, you know, after listening to like Game of Thrones or like some Peter Hamilton, if I saw like, was it Jim Lee was doing John Lee. If I saw his brother, it's cheaper. Yeah. If I saw John Lee was doing some other sci-fi thing, I'd be like, maybe this will be the same experience, you know,
or at least close to it. And also, I mean, you're right, because there are certain books where it's like some of these guys just have a mastery to convey such nuance between characters. And it really does make such an important difference in the audiobook experience.
Oh my God. I'm listening to an audiobook that you've mentioned a lot, dealing with no names. No titles or names, but maybe dealing with a topic similar of, you know, space disaster and a big far-flung story. And the narrator, her voices are horrible. Horrible. And I've worked with, like, I like the woman who does my, you know, it's always weird when one person does a different voice, you know, voice from a different gender. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. There's a way to find out. And I've listened to like male narrators do female characters. You're like, this is a caricature. This is horrible. This is just, but I'm listening the other way here where like, and it's just these accents and stuff are just bad. And it takes me out of the story because I'm like, this is comically bad. This is really, really bad. I'm amazed this got released like this.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Do you know the publisher who made you that offer? Do you know their track record with audiobook releases?
They're solid. They're a big audiobook publisher. You know, I think that, you know, but it comes down to there's a certain amount of control that regardless who I work with that, you know, I'm giving up, and also the opportunity cost. You know, part of it is that, you know, like, I know, like, I don't, they're not going to pay as much to get a narrator that I want, you know, like, I don't think they'll go with a bigger name. And also, you know, that whole, the $50 bounty thing is a big deal. Like, Open Bayou pulled this up, an ACX article from 2014 with, they interviewed Scott Sigler, and Scott talked about making like 20 grand, you know, all in, you know, one span of time from his fans doing the signups for that. And that's a big, you know, big deal. This is like literally like 4 years ago, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's, the industry has grown and they still do that. So it's to me, it's this, it's so easy now that like, it's not like it was a couple years ago where I avoided doing it because I didn't want to have to process the files. And now because now that what's happened too is Audible's kind of combined the narrator producer role together. You hire that narrator, they produce, they handle the production part of it.
Oh, really?
It's not like I'm getting a bunch of audio files, so I got to format it. I just say, hey, either I'll do the split or, you know, get a good one. Like, I will pay you. I'll pay you whatever to go do this. And
Because this is After Things, the only downside I can see is the temptation to, we've talked about on this program a lot about the temptation to quote unquote do things right is oftentimes the perpetual reason why something doesn't get done at all.
Perfect being the enemy of good.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, hey, how come you haven't launched that show yet? Oh no, when I do, it's coming out and I'm going to do it right. You know, and there's always very good reasons to wait. So if you are in a place where you have the time bandwidth, and it sounds like you're in a place where you could spend the money to get the level of talent that you're interested in, the only thing I would encourage you to do is set deadlines for it so that it doesn't become, you know, an always on the back burner, just about to happen kind of thing.
Oh, 100%. No, I'm looking at it like literally like, you know, in the next, because I was looking at this program like, hey, I think I may go do this sooner or later. And then I got, oh, this publisher. And I'm like, oh, boy. And now I got to decide. And then it's a fight aside, I'll make it happen. But I'm, from what I look at ACX, it's gotten so much easier to use. Like literally I clicked on while talking to you, I go, I'm an author. Like, what's your book? I type in Public Enemy Zero, pulls up, hey, here's your info on your book. Just create an account. And it's like, oh man, you know, like being part of that, it's already in that ecosystem. So
that's when it comes to the Amazon ecosystem, there's a couple of brothers, Brian and Jeffrey Eisenberg, wrote a book, Be Like Amazon. They spent a lot of time trying to figure out what works about Amazon. I think I mentioned some of this, but one of the stickier images that I liked is a reminder that friction exists in any transaction.
Yeah.
The question is, do you want the customer to experience that friction, or do you want to do what it takes to make it a frictionless experience for the customer? And that's something that Amazon, you know, behind the scenes, you know, we've seen them make all these logistical breakthroughs and automate things and all that stuff. That was an insane amount of time, energy, and money that went in to create all that. But it really does create this frictionless experience for the consumer. And now it sounds like they're doing the same thing for producers as well. They're making it a frictionless experience to get your books over there, to create a more efficient marketplace.
They've done that to the point that, like, if you use CreateSpace, which is another one of their companies, to do a print version of their book, they've improved the tools a bit. Some of those tools could be a lot better, but they've improved it a lot. Once you make a print version of your book and you've uploaded that audio file, they have a link like, hey, I want to make this an ebook. Mm-hmm. Click this button. We'll just take this. And if you do an ebook, like, hey, want to make this a print book? We'll show you how to create space. Like they've really done that. And that's, I've taken that to heart. Like when I have a project right now, I'm like, I'm spending a lot of time at code project. Like I've got to make this as frictionless as possible because it's one of those things where there are like so many times where like, ah, I want to go buy this. Oh, I'm sorry. We only use this payment system. We don't use these other ones. Like there's the donation one that I've got to donate multiple times. Like, oh no, you've got to go do this other thing. I'm like, I'm sorry. If you gave me a PayPal button, you'd have money,
right.
But you didn't. And my caring ended, which is a horrible thing to say.
And exactly. Like what you want is the feeling of I did a good thing. They now have money. And what you don't want to do is have a homework assignment that involves making this a challenge.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think I've taken it to heart. I think once I make my decision that I need to make the thing happen and do that.
Hey, so if you don't mind scooting into picks, today's a weird one because I have more homework than usual going into Cord Killers. I do have a pick that I'm excited about. Ooh. And yeah, you know that awesome feeling when you when you hear about a podcast and you start listening to it, and the first episode, you're like, oh, I get it, and I like this, and then you just feel this wave of, oh, and there's 60 more to go, mm-hmm. And you just realize this is going to be what you listen to for the next month.
Sure.
I just had that for a podcast called Business Wars. I heard about it from one of the folks who was doing an appearance on Harmontown, and they were talking about how they take all the great wars of business. They tell the two sides. In this case, I am starting with Sony versus Nintendo. And so there, it's a six episode arc where, of course, you have to hear about how did Nintendo come to launch the NES? You know, what was their story? Because they were a playing card company that just got highly experimental. They ran a taxi service at one point. They rented hotels by the hour for the love hotels, and then at some point they had this 6-in-1, you know, hook it up to a TV game gadget, and it took off. And then they had
with a robot.
Did it? Oh, no. You're talking about the NES.
This is before we get
to the NES, right? Because before that,
it was the Game and Watch.
They did. That was their second hit, yeah. Right? The first one was like a Pong thing or whatever, 6-in-1 Pong thing. But then the Game and Watch thing took off. And interestingly, Donkey Kong, when they shipped it over, the American side of things, they uncrated this thing and they're like, you gotta be freaking kidding me. This isn't in space. This is a dumpy dude in overalls. And what is a Donkey Kong? You know, like this is all nonsense. And of course it became one of the biggest games. When they launched the NES, They couldn't get any retailer to carry it. All the retails, 2 years, they went to CES, and 2 years, all the retailers said, nope, we just watched the crash, Atari's out. It's clear that video games are not a thing anymore. Yeah. And then, and so the,
good call on that.
They called back to Japan where it was, they were selling like crazy. And, they're like, yeah, everyone says video games are not a thing. And the reply from, Nintendo Japan was like, they're wrong. People they're not done with games. They're done with bad games. And so, they picked one market. They picked, New York City, and they spent millions and millions and millions of dollars to force basically putting it on the market and to advertise it in that space. And they only sold 50,000 units over that year, but it was good enough that now they had the attention of the retailers. And then, of course, you know, that rolled out. And then interestingly, then you hear about stuff from the Sony side as they were developing the PlayStation.
Yeah.
There's lots of interesting stories about what they intended to do with it and how it went sideways.
Because the PlayStation was originally going to be a Nintendo 64 collaboration with Nintendo.
Exactly, right? Yeah. But so now they're taking on Nintendo, and they're taking meetings with Konami. And the guy from Konami says, look, when you sell 3 million, we will consider making games for it. Until then, this is too speculative or whatever. And then he's just getting ready to leave, and the guy's like, hey, by the way, you know, we do games. Every year we run a study on whether or not we should build a console. And every year the answer comes back, no, you're not going to beat Nintendo. It's too big of a gamble or whatever. And so they figured out that they needed to go on a charm offensive if they were going to woo developers into it. They only had Namco, and they're like, we can't launch with this. And, you know, in Nintendo press conferences, they're openly laughing and mocking Sony. They're like, yeah, give it a year. Nobody will care. And then they figured out, they needed to speak to the interests of the developer. Mm-hmm. And so then they only hammered on two things. Three things. Number one, lower licensing fees than Nintendo, which you would expect. But then they kept hammering on discs are cheap and fast to make. Cartridges are not. Yeah. Average cost of construction a cartridge is $30. It is $6 to press the CD. When you run out because you have a runaway hit, it takes 3 months to make cartridges and get them out. It takes 3 weeks to get it out with CDs. Mm-hmm. And so now all of a sudden they had the interest. And so I'm about halfway through it. But this whole podcast, Business Wars, is filled with all these stories. Coke versus Pepsi, all these.
That's great.
Real quick add to that point. It sounds like that a lot of that, like the book by Stephen Kent, which is The Ultimate History of Video Games, on 21 hours. I love reading about or listening to the history of video games more than I love playing them. It goes into those stories, everything, the whole story of service games, you know, where did, you know, Sega come from, all of that. And it's an amazing story. They go into like the whole history of the Famicom game and watch all that stuff, different companies, Atari, which is, if you want to dive way deeper into that, which it sounds like this podcast is a great point to go, this is cool, I want to know more. But yeah, The Ultimate History of Video Games.
Yeah, I'm going to pick that up right now.
I absolutely adored this thing. Like, I gave this, like, you know, 5 stars all across. So
Ultimate History.
And Polygon did a really long oral history on Final Fantasy VII last year or the year before. And it was a very similar thing because that was right around the time of the PlayStation launch. And so they talked to the people who were at Square at the time of, like, being wooed by Sony and having to basically kill this, you know, long-standing relationship that they had with Nintendo because, you know, the PlayStation had better hardware, it had discs and the licensing fees and stuff. All that stuff is fascinating when you get into the weeds of, like, the business side of it and you know, how those relationships change.
I mean, and it really is such an interesting chicken and egg scenario. You need to have the titles to get the people to sell the units so that you could attract the developers for the titles.
Yeah.
That was what made Microsoft interesting to Xbox, and their first solution was, we'll buy Bungie.
All right, so I just bought The Ultimate History of Video Games.
Brian, I hope you. I mean, you're going to get way even more out of it than I did, and I loved it because it was just so cool. Okay. Bryce,
you know, if we're doing podcasty sort of stuff, I picked this on the show a little while ago, and they're about to have a new episode, so I'm going to pick it again. It's the Dark Ages podcast, darkagesshow.com. It is a monthly audio drama disguised as a podcast. About it's a workplace comedy in a fantasy museum.
Oh, so hold on. This sounds, if I'm categorizing it correctly, yeah, like a Welcome to Night Vale type thing, where it's pretending to be one thing, but you're really hearing the story of what.
Yeah, and it's not even really. It's not like Night Vale, where Night Vale is like a radio show kind of thing. This is just, it's an audiobook, but it's a monthly podcast.
Got it.
And it is great. They have really fantastic readers, and it's interesting to see it as a piece of writing, not just as a piece of like production, because you're like, oh, how do we get this character, you know, when we don't have any stage direction or any sort of narrator to say what they're thinking. Oh, well, I don't know. We'll make him go on a walk during a quiet alley. And this is the alley where he goes and talks his thoughts and little things like that.
They make him like E.B. Farnham in Deadwood, just constantly talking to himself.
Yeah. I think it's really funny. And the stories that they set up of like, oh, well, you know, this museum just got this great new crown from the Dark Lord. But the Dark Lord wants his crown back. Oh. And the way they resolve that and how they continue to build on top of that in the second episode is really good. And they have a new third episode coming up this in a week or so. So I'm really excited for that. It's the Dark Ages.
We live in an amazing time of audio. I mean, audio being, you know, we're here, you're thinking this is the point when everybody be excited about 3D and things like this. What we're really excited about is all the different platforms of which we can enjoy audio, because production costs are a lot lower, but we have so much more time to consume those kinds of things.
Yeah.
So it's cool. I'm going to stick with, you know, my pick will be The Ultimate History of Video Games.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. You saw,
21 hours.
I was astonished. I'm looking at it right now. 634 ratings, and it looks like it's almost perfectly 5 stars.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's a 21 hours. So it's, you just can't really did his research. I don't think he did anything else either. It's one of these things, like, I remember, like, I'm going to read everything by this guy. And so, then it was like, that's the one audio book.
So what time range is this? It looks like, you know, it's going back to, you know, the mid, late 70s. But does this, how far into the future?
How close to present day does it get?
Well, I guess I think this printed in 2001, so probably.
I think 2001 is kind of where it sort of comes to a stop.
That's one of the nice things is like, yeah, I'm pretty sure I know what happens, give or take, after that part.
Yeah, you
know?
I went on a kick after I read this, and you know, and then I read, you know, the service games, which is all about Sega. I read, you know, things about Mario composing. I read things. I think I had the story about like Doom. I read a bunch of different sort of things. You know, I just went sideways into like more specific stories about other ones. So there's a lot of great, like, more about, because you can take one game, you know, one game company, you can do an entire history on it. And gaming is funny because, and it's the argument I kind of try to make is that if you're a gamer and you're into games, it feels like it's a, everybody knows about it, everybody's into it. Where if you don't play it, you don't know it. Where a movie, you can see a trailer, you can know about a movie. We all know about movies we don't see. We barely, if you don't play a game, a certain game, like, I mean, I'll watch, like, I had to watch an introduction to Fortnite because, like, I need to know what this is. You know, I'm not going to play it, but I want to understand what people are talking about and then trying to get, like, why is this so cool, you know?
Well, and as more smaller development teams and publishers are able to make more games and, you know, have a closer connection to their fan base, and when they only need a smaller fan base to have success, you know, in these digital marketplaces, you have more history stories being told every week. You know, there was a thing last week about this developer who made a sequel to a game that they put out last year, an okay sort of battle royale type game that they just went and made a complete different sequel to, and a single digit number of people bought it. And so they were like, okay, well, we're canceling this game that we released. We are all getting refunds because we misread everything. But all of that is happening in real time and very immediately. You know, there's like video of the COO saying like, yeah, you know, we misread the room and you guys clearly didn't want this game. You wanted us to keep supporting this other online game. And, you know, there are always stories like that. But I bet you guys probably didn't even hear about that story at all.
What was the title again?
The Culling.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, definitely didn't.
But stuff like that is happening constantly, and untold numbers of backdoor things, you know?
Yeah.
It's a crazy world. It's getting all niche-y. Gentlemen, it's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.